From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Always nice to have you with us on the podcast when it's not a weekday show. We do this every weekend. Did you know that? Did you know that, Megan?
I did know that.
You did know
that? I am here for everyone.
Every weekend. So if you like Connections, I hope you're not only listening to the podcast and versions of Connections, which is just the audio versions, but the actual podcast. Fresh content every weekend, especially if you missed the shows. These are the moments from the week that stand out to us. And let's get going.
Before we get going,
Megan, yeah.
I think we should introduce a video element because you were just showing me some awesome dance moves that I think our listeners might enjoy. Maybe we should Facebook Live the next podcast.
Talking about dance moves that people can't see is good radio.
That's why I said video.
Oh, a video component of my dance moves. Maybe not the best idea.
He's flossing, everyone. So if you want to see Evan Dawson floss, email me.
I don't know
me.
How to floss. I was trying to figure out what it might look like. I can't do the floss. And I can't do much of any dances.
Well, we'll see. Maybe we'll have a special surprise video next week. We'll see.
Let's do this. Should we get going here?
Sure. We're running out of time.
These poor listeners. And there was a lot that happened this week. Let's start with the moment that seemed to impact everyone in the studio and many of our listeners as well.
We discussed the education of boys and young men of color. Our panel included Leonard Brock, who directs the local anti-poverty initiative, along with Jason Willis, the director of African American Studies for the Rochester City School District. Also in studio, Cecilia Golden, the deputy superintendent for curriculum.
Now, Brock explained that even though he's become a leader in the community and the director of a massive and important initiative, he still feels dismissed in professional settings because of the color of his skin. Let's listen.
Others may not necessarily perceive me the way I perceive myself. And I give you three examples. People may see me in different contexts and think that either I'm aggressive or I am volatile, hostile, because I'm not necessarily forceful, because I am assertive as it relates to just using information and data. Second is individuals may dismiss you because they feel like the only way that you're in a room is because you are on a tokenized assignment to get something done versus an appreciation for the qualities and the qualifications and your value add to the context and what it is. And then third, we're still rarities in the rooms in which we occupy. So it's very common for me to be the only African-American male in a room. And I oftentimes have to speak 2, 3, 4 times in order to get one point across, when in reality, that's not the same courtesy that's given to others. And that's just
A couple of pieces.
Everyone in this room, when you said that there are times where you feel like the room assumes you are there because you're an African-American, not because of your skills.
Exactly.
Everyone in this room was nodding. Have you all experienced that?
Absolutely.
Felt that?
On a regular basis.
Yes.
It's a part of a conditioning, right? No one would step into your office and assume that you haven't been prepared, that you're not the best guy for this job. And we as a Rochester community salute you. You are the best guy for this job. There are many people that tap in this program because of the spirit that you bring and the even keel, but you're the best guy for this job. You don't have to get challenged in that chair. Oftentimes in professional paradigms, wherever I go, specifically under the umbrella of African American studies, you have to fight those challenges, and many of them are cerebral. So because there's been layers of conditioning over time and space, one's mental state must filter everything that's calibrating in a moment, all of those lenses, all of those personalities or epistemologies, ontologies that are a part of your presence and your being, and you just want to help kids. You just want to love children. You just want people to do their best in their occupation for kids.
A person once made reference, and I'm not saying that this is right or wrong. They said, you don't have the privilege to have an opinion, but you have an opportunity and responsibility to use data. And I didn't understand what they meant. They said, if you have an opinion in these spaces, oftentimes you will be dismissed because people don't see you as an African-American male who's educated as having the right information. But if you use data to equip your argument, people will have more of an understanding and an appreciation for you and what you have to say versus you having an opinion. And I argue with that within myself for quite some time, but I know it to be true.
So think about children, right? We're grown. We've got coping mechanisms. We've got the experience to, know how to, quote, play the game. We know when we're dealing with some adversarial
energies,
right. But think about children who aren't given the opportunity to express opinions, right? Without someone thinking that they're challenging authority. Think about children who, because of the ways in which the curriculum may be, or the pedagogical practices may be, or the disconnect in the books that are being written, that the child then doesn't do well and then has, quote, failed. And no one asks the question, has the child failed the system or has the system failed the child? So what happens then is many of our black males and some black females are being repeated, retained in grade, when we know that the vast majority of students that drop out have been retained earlier on in their academic programming. So these are the kinds of things that I have to look at and have wanted to, and to switch. The struggle shouldn't be this hard in 2018 for these African-American males sitting around the table and those who are not sitting around the table, and the African-American males and females in our schools today. That's our work. That's the work that we have before us.
Next, a conversation about the emotional impact of foster care and adoption on kids. This week, Evan and I learned about a part of American history that we weren't familiar with before, orphan trains. In the early 1900s, orphaned, abandoned, and homeless children in Eastern American cities were placed on trains heading west with the hope of finding new homes. Many of the kids who had these experiences later spoke about the loneliness and uncertainty they faced on their journeys. Local adoption experts say those feelings are similar to what's experienced by kids in the foster care system today.
In this clip, you'll hear from a local adoptive mother. Alicia Dougherty has 8 children. 4 were adopted through the foster system. You'll hear her talk about the challenges she and her husband faced as new parents after they adopted their first son, Alex, when he was 5. Here's Alicia.
The biggest shocker for us was that he didn't trust us. Because here in our minds, we're these trustworthy, supportive parents. But to him, we were strangers. And he didn't know if he could trust us or not. We needed to prove that trust. And the only way to do that is time, and over time, repeatedly proving your trust. It's not something that's earned immediately.
Wow, that's a big, powerful point, because you're probably thinking, we've been going through this process. Alex, you got no idea how hard we've been working on this. You're everything we want.
Yeah.
And you want him to know all of that coming in the door. But of course he doesn't. And of course, you know, some kids who go through the foster care system may have many reasons not to trust.
Right.
So how did that relationship develop?
For us, we did a lot of regression therapy type stuff. You know, he was a big 5-year-old, but all he wanted was to be treated like a baby. And so there's just some of that cuddling and snuggling and rocking that you have to do, because that earns trust with children. And always making sure you follow through on your word. If you say, we're going to the pumpkin patch today, and it doesn't happen, you just totally erased any trust that he had built up in you. You always have to follow through on your word.
Wow. Is this something that's earned and sort of evolved gradually? Did you have a moment where, you know, you say to the rest of your family who are getting to know Alex, it changed today, or a light kind of flipped?
I think it's gradual.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's definitely a long, tiring process, but it is also an extremely rewarding process.
What's the relationship with Alex like now?
Alex is my right-hand man. He's 12 years old now. I could not do this crazy life without him. He is just amazing. He's the best big brother to the younger 7 siblings.
Oh, I'm sorry, 7. So
7.
I don't know if I had the right number there. All right, so we just started with Alex, so now we're walking through this. 2 years later, you adopted, at the time, a 6-year-old, right?
Yes.
James.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Also from the foster care system.
Yes.
So when you're making these decisions, you have to decide. I mean, at some point you have to decide, we want more of this. This is, you know, it may be hard at times. It's worth it. Yeah?
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
And did you ever doubt that?
No.
Never doubted that?
No.
Okay. And so tell me about James.
James is now 11. He came to us when he was 6. He was in the foster care system, and he had been for 4 years needing an adoptive home. And because of his past, many people were scared off by him. He was just one of those kids in the system who unfortunately has a long paperwork trail that doesn't accurately describe him. So he actually came to us from a day treatment program. And from there, we just advocated as hard as we could to get him the services that he needed to be successful in a family setting.
When you say the paperwork didn't accurately describe him, why do you think that was? What do you mean by that?
I believe that the environment he was living in at the time, it was not a healthy environment for him, and he acted out exponentially in his day treatment program. And you look at the paperwork on him, and here he is throwing chairs at teachers and screaming at everybody, and deep down in there was just this kid who wanted to be loved.
You had the advantage 2 years after adopting Alex of having probably the expectation that it's going to take some time.
Yes.
And, you know, again, building up that trust, et cetera. Did you see similarities with James that you saw with Alex? Maybe a lack of trust at first, a similar development that happened?
Yep. It was pretty much the same thing all over again. Needed to earn that trust, needed to earn the title mom and dad, and just be consistent.
Are they willing to call you mom and dad pretty quickly?
They are, yes. Okay. I find that they are clinging to someone to call mom and dad.
Interesting. But still in your mind, you kind of felt like you had to earn the title, that they may call you that, but they have to respect you that and really feel it in
yes.
their sort of in their bones that is mom and dad.
Yes.
Okay. That I can trust that this is mom and dad now, that this is a real relationship that's going to last, et cetera. Does it get easier when you do it multiple times, understanding the process?
Yes, I believe so.
You do?
It does, yes. People say, how can you do it all over again? And it's like, well, once you've done it once, you can just do it again.
How did Alex take that? You say Alex is a good big brother. How did it go at first?
Alex, at first, kind of saw competition, you know, the sibling rivalry, the jealousy, but we kept instilling in him, you know, now you have other people to play with. You don't have to only play with mom and dad.
I want to ask you, if I could, Alicia, just to tell me a little bit and really tell listeners who have heard us discuss trauma and the impact of trauma. And you really started to get into it with the idea that, you know, when you've had to bring children into your household who might not even safely assume that there's going to be food here, that there will be a parent here, that I'll be safe here. How do you see trauma impact Alex, James, the twins in sort of day-to-day ways? And do you see that change over time? In other words, does the impact of trauma lessen when they are surrounded by love?
It does lessen. What happens now is that there can be triggers for their PTSD, and you don't know when the triggers will happen. It could be something as simple as a police car drove past with its siren and lights on, and they're triggered back to that moment when they were removed from their birth family. And then from there, you have to rework again, telling them that they're safe and loved and they're not going anywhere.
Do you see something happen and do you generally know that, oh boy, this could be a trigger, or does it surprise you sometimes? Is it difficult that way?
It can surprise you sometimes. Yes, definitely. I've had school call and say, you know, James is having a tough day. Hmm. Something triggered him, and we have to kind of rewind our minds. Okay, what has happened that triggered him? And we make trips to school often to kind of reassure him that you're not going anywhere. You're staying here in our family. Alex now, who's been with us 8 years, has finally accepted and understands that he's not going anywhere. So this is just something we know we have to earn with the other three.
Finally this week, the fate of your local shopping mall. Many publications are blaming millennials for killing malls. The old habit of wandering aimlessly through a mall, hitting a dozen stores,
That's changing for a lot of us. Obviously, many Americans do a lot of their shopping online. And by 2022, economists predict a wave of new mall closures.
We sat down with Dennis Wilmot of Wilmorite, which owns and operates three local malls and Pittsford Plaza. He didn't hesitate to say that malls have to change. Eastview wants to lure a Tesla dealership. Marketplace Mall could soon change either to outlet stores or to a whole new lifestyle center with housing and medical offices. Wilmot says it's adapt or die, and they're trying to do the former.
While we continue to invest money to make the experience better, whether that's through common areas, new additions, new experiences, there is a limitation as to how much we can do, because if retailer isn't going to reciprocate that effort, that is out of our control. As it relates specific to about the trends and really what has been occurring over, I'd say probably the past 6 to 10 years, and with the downturn in 2008, that obviously agitated a lot of economic issues. But you know, our industry back in its early stages in the 50s, with the GDP of the U.S. economy being driven by discretionary consumer expenditures up to 60% or 70%, which is essentially mostly retail, you know, our cycles were completely dependent on the economy and how the consumer, or if the consumer, was spending. And when there were downturns, the consumers stopped spending, the retailers contracted, they closed stores. When the economy recovered, the consumer spent more money and the retailers expanded. And it was a fairly predictable cycle, certainly for us. But what has changed, and there's a lot of different reasons, but I think technology, the shopping habits of the millennial generation in part, we have not seen that recovery. And if you look based on employment, you know, all the economy is running very well right now. People are spending money, but they're not necessarily spending money in the same places they did in decades past. So while there is a continued contraction in terms of store count, which ultimately flows down to less malls because there's less demand for space, the industry is looking for what I would say an equilibrium, where there is going to be a balance. I don't think retail in terms of a four-wall format is going the way of the dinosaurs, but it is going through an adjustment, and it's incumbent on owners like ourselves to react proactively, if you will, to these changes, because in some cases, and if we want to talk about Irondequoit, we can, you know, the reaction was too late. And once a mall heads in a certain direction, it is unstoppable in terms of the outcome of that property. And in the case of our assets here in Rochester, we've tried and continue to hope to stay ahead of that change.
And that is another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast.
Dance podcast.
The dance podcast. Dance break. Up. Listeners can't crank the music. Dance break. You can't see these moves.
It's something else. There's a lot of knee bending.
Dance break time. Our thanks to Barsook Records and Rah Rah Riot for providing the music that we love for Connections and Weekend Connections. You can hear the regular talk show, noon to 2, weekday afternoons, on AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan, the dance master. I'm Megan, just trying to keep everybody sane.
Dance break!
Thanks for listening. We will talk to you Monday.